CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor. Ukraine conflict and Russia. The article in The Atlantic magazine by Anne Applebaum and Jeffrey Goldberg, distinguished commentators on conflict in Europe, and the response by my guest and colleague Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, turns on the question of Ukraine's success. Does that transfer all of that success into Russia's defeat, Russia's failure? And what are the consequences of that, not only for Eastern Europe, but for the planet, for all of us, of the failure of a great civilization into a future that strikes me as dystopian? It's chapter one of a nightmare. Anatole, a very good evening to you. Thank you very much. Your response turns on the parts of the essay that are most challenging to what comes next. However, it's easy to endorse the parts of the essay. It's extremely well informed about what Ukraine must do to achieve success. As I understand it, this is the essay for the maximalist position. Ukraine must have everything it needs in order to retake Crimea. Do I read that correctly? Good evening to you.
Hello, John. Yes, I mean, that's their position, that the West must give basically everything that Ukraine wants in order to help Ukraine win a complete victory over Russia, including the recovery not just of the territory that Russia has seized since its invasion last year, but the eastern Donbass, which has been in effect separate from Ukraine since 2014, and Crimea, which Russia also took that year, and which was part of Russia until 1954. And they hope explicitly in this piece that this will also lead to the fall of the Putin regime in Russia, and that as a result, Russia will be so weakened, its political order will be so divided, that Russia will no longer be a great power and will no longer in future be able to threaten Ukraine. So that is their position, yes.
And a maximalist position is not something that is enjoyed everywhere in NATO, in the European Union, or in the U.S. So your measure of the maximalist position, is it rhetorical? Is it a glove thrown down on the ground, a challenge to the to Russia? Because it sounds very much like it endorses the Kremlin's interpretation of this war. This is not about Ukraine freedom. This is about destroying Russia.
Well, yes, indeed. You've put your finger on it. I mean, in a funny way, Applebaum and Goldberg agree with Putin. And undoubtedly, you know, I mean, Putin will cite them and the Russian government will cite them in their rhetoric, just as they've quoted Annalena Baerbock, the German foreign minister, saying that Germany is at war with Russia. Of course, I mean, it isn't, but saying so is a great help to Russian rhetoric. Because, of course, as I believe I've said on this program before, it's very embarrassing for the Russian government to have been, in effect, defeated already by the Ukrainians. If you can present this to the Russian people, that Russia is fighting not Ukraine, but the whole of the West, and that the West or powerful voices within the West want to use this war to destroy Russia as a great power, or even destroy it as a state, well then, you know, that lets Putin off the hook and his regime for all its, you know, disastrous failures.
I want to look carefully at your analysis of what right now is the Ukraine conflict with Russia, because you've recently come back and you witnessed and you visited parts that the Applebaum Goldberg essay point to as predicate for total victory, for maximalists. First, the war crimes in and around Kyiv in the early days of the war. You visited those sites. You take no issue with the fact that there must be justice, correct?
That depends what you mean by justice, John, because the problem is, in an ideal world, yes, but certainly, I mean, the Ukrainians are are justified in putting on trial Russian prisoners who they have, you know, solid evidence to suggest committed war crimes. But putting the Russian government on trial, or putting, you know, Russian soldiers who have not been captured by the Ukrainians on trial, requires a Nuremberg process, as indeed many international lawyers and politicians in the West and in Ukraine have advocated. President Zelensky has called for this. But of course, to bring about the Nuremberg trials and the similar trials in Japan after 1945, Germany and Japan had to be totally defeated and occupied by American, or in the case of Germany, American, British, and Soviet troops. Faced with that, that's not going to happen. But secondly, if there were any chance of it happening, there is no question whatsoever that Russia would escalate towards the use of nuclear weapons. You know, as America's nuclear deterrent is there to preserve the American state, so is Russia's. I mean, at that point, you are looking into the nuclear abyss. And you then have to ask yourselves, how many dead is justice worth? The other point I have to say is that, of course, the United States itself has not just refused to submit itself to the International Criminal Court, refused to recognize the International Criminal Court, but has threatened with very harsh sanctions anyone who tries to make America or American servicemen and officials subject to the International Criminal Court. And of course, America has done that for a very good reason, because the atrocities committed by Russian troops north of Kyiv, in the context, by the way, of what was in effect a Ukrainian civilian insurgency, are very close indeed to those committed by US and other Western soldiers in the past in counterinsurgencies in Vietnam, for example, even to a lesser degree in Iraq. So of course America is not going to submit itself to trials for this. But of course that's why so much of the rest of the world, from India through Brazil, South Africa, accuses America and the West of double standards in this regard. And that's why, you know, these calls, they may have support in the West. They're obviously very strongly supported in Ukraine, but they are not supported by a majority of governments around the world, including, in effect, if not rhetorically, by the United States.
Much of the Applebaum-Goldberg essay turns on a conversation with President Zelensky, whom you note is in a position where exaggeration is useful. He's talking to a variety of audiences when he's commenting. However, I take most seriously the question of civilization and the conduct of this war in front of the success, apparently, of the European Union, the success, apparently, of the United States, and the contest right now underway between the East and the West, the trade contest, the confrontation in other parts of the world. Civilization is it's something that you cite when you're gathering your forces in order to advance to a point. How do you read the word civilization in Europe right now? Is this a war for civilization? Do other capitals see it that way? Or do they see it practically as a disruption in globalization?
Well, elsewhere in the world, it's certainly seen as the latter. And I have to say, in India, whenever the term Western civilization has come up in a conversation during my visits to India, someone has quoted Mahatma Gandhi's words about Western civilization. When he was asked about this, he replied, "It would be a good idea." In other words, he hasn't seen it yet. And I have to say, this kind of language is absolutely infuriating to the rest of the world. Because they simply see it as the old Western colonial civilizing mission under a new guise. And of course, when it comes to war crimes and crimes of aggression, I mean, you know, it's not that countries, once again, like India or Brazil, have approved Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because they haven't. They voted to condemn it in the United Nations. But they don't see that much difference, certainly not a deep civilizational difference, between what Russia is doing in Ukraine today and what, you know, America and other Western countries, including Britain, have done in Iraq and elsewhere in the past. There is also a very strong perception elsewhere in the world that, you know, we in the West really care about Ukraine, not on civilizational grounds, but partly on simply geopolitical ones, and partly because the Ukrainians are white. It is striking that Western journalism never talks about collateral damage when it comes to the war in Ukraine, whereas, you know, every U.S. Airstrike in Afghanistan, for example, you know, even on a wedding party in which 50, you know, women and children were killed in an effort to kill one Taliban commander, there was always in the Western media, you know, references to how this was unfortunately unintended collateral damage, and Pentagon excuses were repeated. So, you know, you do have to understand why this is not viewed in the same way in much of Asia and Africa and Latin America.
Well, that connects us with the story that we've been following for months and months and months, which is how this achieves something better than we have right now, because the maximalist position combined with statements that this is a war for civilization leaves us here in NATO, U.S. participating in NATO, with a mission to carry on, even presuming there is some kind of ceasefire or peacemaking along the frontier. NATO is then engaged in an arms race, right? Really, that's what we're looking at here. Not an end to Ukraine conflict, but the Ukraine conflict becomes like the Balkans for the first war.
Yeah. Now, I mean, the thing is, I strongly believe that Ukraine should be helped to join the European Union. Now, the European Union is not perfect. And as we see from the examples of Hungary and Poland, and even in different ways, Romania and Bulgaria, it doesn't lead to a total miraculous cultural transformation towards some ideal Western liberal democratic civilization. But undoubtedly, it has had a very positive effect across large parts of, you know, former communist Eastern Europe. But that, in my view, is the transformation that we need to help and work towards, you know, rather than this overblown language of civilization, which is basically not so much, in my view, an attempt to help Ukraine as an attempt to destroy Russia. Because, of course, people who really care about Ukraine have to, you know, think about what the real interests of real Ukrainians are. And it's difficult to see that those interests are served by a war that goes on forever, that involves more and more destruction, that involves, you know, a risk of escalation of which Ukraine would be the first victim, and which prevents permanently any chance of Ukraine actually joining the European Union, because that process can't even begin as long as the war goes on. So, you know, one has to ask, I mean, all too often in Washington and in other Western capitals as well, a language of helping a country or a movement is used when the purpose is actually to hurt somebody else. And, you know, I remember back in 89, when a colleague, Kathy Gannon of AP, and I were covering Afghanistan and Pakistan together. And we asked an American diplomat, called himself a diplomat, you know, why America was going on supporting the radical Afghan Mujahideen when the Soviet Union was already withdrawing. What was the point of going on to try to destroy the communist government of Afghanistan, risk destroying the state, which is, of course, exactly what happened, and risk empowering radical Islamist elements who hate America? And After being pushed back and pushed back, and after several drinks, he actually said explicitly, look, this isn't about Afghanistan, this is about Vietnam. They did it to us in Vietnam. I think he'd served in Vietnam. You know, they did it to us in Vietnam. They humiliated us. They defeated us. We're going to do the same to Russia. And he clearly had no interest in the actual well-being of Afghanistan or Afghans at all. That was not what this was about. I've never forgotten that. And it's colored my views of every subsequent such conflict.
We're going to Red Square momentarily with Anatole Lieben of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.